Welcome to Techtopia, the podcast about a better future. I'm John Biggs. Today on the show, we have Elliot Pepper. He's a novelist, and his recent book, The Veil, is out in May. This is Techtopia. This episode of Technotopia is sponsored by CheapTranscription.io. CheapTranscription offers 10 cent per minute transcription using our happy robots or 85 cents per minute using our human assistants. CheapTranscription.io is cheaper and faster than everyone else. CheapTranscription.io. This episode of Technotopia is brought to you by Typewriter.plus. Typewriter.plus is a full-service editorial agency that brings amazing editors from places like the New York Times and TechCrunch to work on your writing. Need a blog post, a white paper, a presentation? The Typewriter team can write or edit anything on nearly any topic. Visit them at typewriter.plus for a free quote. That's typewriter.plus, typewriter.plus. Welcome back to Technotopia, the podcast about a better future. I'm John Biggs. Today on the show, we have Elliot Pepper. He's a author of 9 books now. I guess the latest one is coming out in May. Why don't you tell us about your what you're working on, Elliot?
Yeah. The new book's called Veil. All of my books are near future science fiction thrillers. So I'm really fascinated by how technology shapes our lives and shapes the world. And so all of my science fiction basically wrestles with that and looks at different aspects of that sort of intersection of technology and culture. So this new one, Veil, that's coming out in May. Looks at geoengineering, which I actually only first learned about a couple of years ago when I was listening to a podcast. This was it was Tyler Cohen interviewing Charles C. Mann, who's an award-winning science journalist, and he was describing how there are these like a growing body of scientific research into how to intentionally manipulate the global climate in order to combat the worst effects of global warming. So at Harvard and Stanford and many other, academic research areas, as well as certain privately funded ones, like Bill Gates famously is investing a lot in this area. People are looking at how you could, seed the oceans with bacteria or build machines that suck CO2 out of the air, and a bunch of other ways that you could try to limit the sort of worst impacts of global warming. And I was listening to him describe this, and he was explaining how of all of the different approaches that people have suggested for how you could do geoengineering, one is by far the most feasible and well-documented. And basically what you do is you fly high-altitude planes into the stratosphere and spray a bunch of inert aerosols, which basically just means dust. So you spray a bunch of dust into the stratosphere, which makes the Earth, the entire planet, just a tiny bit shinier, a tiny bit more reflective. And so incoming sunlight, a tiny percentage of incoming sunlight scatters back into space, basically reflects off the stratosphere back into space. And so therefore, you get a little bit less energy coming into the Earth system, which directly cools the global climate, right? So if you're, if you're worried about the climate getting, 2 degrees warmer or more, you could theoretically try to combat that by spraying the correct amount of dust into the stratosphere to bring that temperature down. Now, this happens every time a major volcano explodes.
Okay.
When a volcano explodes, it sprays a bunch of matter, a bunch of dust into the stratosphere and cools the climate. So if you look historically, anytime there's a major volcanic explosion, the next couple years, you have global cooling, right? When a volcano explodes, there are other reasons you don't want a volcano to explode, but one of them is that it's spraying a lot of nasty stuff, right? A lot of noxious gases and things like that that cause acid rain and things. So you wouldn't want to use the same dust that a volcano shoots into the stratosphere, but you could, manufacture your own dust and put it up there that's inert and so it doesn't cause things like acid rain. And so that sounds crazy. It sounds like a James Bond villain kind of move, mm-hmm. right? But here's the craziest part. The craziest part is that it would only cost about $2 billion a year to do this, and it's achievable today with no new advances in technology. And okay. So, you know, when you think about what it means for the global economy to transition away from fossil fuels, you're looking at many, many, many trillions of dollars of economic change, right? And when you look at, the history of global or climate change policy, it's like basically, so far our political institutions, the UN and national governments, have basically done a very poor job of effectively addressing climate change as a problem, which is why, I live in California and we have huge wildfires every year, mm-hmm. right? You saw the wildfires in Australia, you have sea level rise, drought, all of these, we're living through climate change, but our governments haven't done a great job so far of adapting, and our economy hasn't either. And so the weird thing about this kind of geoengineering is that literally any single government on Earth, or even if a few individual billionaires could do this unilaterally without even telling anyone, right? Or certainly without asking anyone for permission. And like you might start seeing the climate cool again, and that would cause a whole bunch of other problems, right? Like certainly it would be politically contentious, to say the least, right? Like, who gets to make the decision about how you're manipulating the climate and all of this kind of stuff? So mm-hmm. when I heard Charles Mann describe this body of research on the podcast, I was like, oh my God, can you imagine the social implications, the political implications, the environmental implications, the economic implications? Like, this is a crazy scenario. Somebody needs to write a novel about this. And that's where Vail was born. That's where the novel got its start.
All right, that's pretty cool. So basically the idea is that Bill Gates could fly a plane up and fill the sky with dust and nobody would actually know, right?
I mean, like he'd have to have a plausible cover story for flying a bunch of planes in the stratosphere, right? But yeah, like basically anyone who with enough resources could start doing that. And I mean, you'd see the results very quickly. Like the minute you start doing it, less sunlight starts coming in, right? Mm-hmm. So, you'd see the results that year. And then you have to think about, well, okay, like there are a number of really interesting sort of like moral questions that come in here, right? Like, first of all, who gets to decide to do something like this? It's a similar problem of like, almost with nuclear weapons, where it's, one person could make a decision that would like dramatically impact the entire planet. Mm-hmm.
You're saying one guy could make this decision, which is wild.
Right. It's crazy. Right. And like, that's something that is new for our species. Like, before basically 100 years ago, like there was no such thing as one, like there was no one decision that one single human being could make that would have that level of like global implications for every other human alive and every other species alive. Right. So it's weird that we find ourselves in this situation where technology has basically leveraged, certain individuals' decisions to impact the world on a species-wide level. And this is an example of that, right? Mm-hmm. And I think it's also an example of something else that's really interesting, which is that, we used to think about sort of, I guess, like humans and nature as being like, like man versus nature, like that sort of cultural idea that people are not only apart from nature, but that like nature is a thing. It's like you could go to the wilderness and that meant something, mm-hmm. right? Like there was this huge world that was basically beyond the scope of human enterprise that was always out there. And that has really changed. In the past couple hundred years, humans are now one of the principal variables that sets up constraints for every other species, and really changes the entire Earth system and how it works. So like one good example of this is fertilizer, where the fact that humans started using fertilizer really extensively in the early 20th century has actually changed the entire nitrogen cycle of the planet, mm-hmm. right? Which has downstream implications for basically every species alive. And so we are doing things that, we're doing things all the time that are literally changing how the biosphere functions. And geoengineering is basically a term for humans doing those kinds of things, changing the Earth system intentionally, right? So if you think about cars, right, like we started driving cars because we wanted to move, it was a really cool technology that was better than horses. And meant that like you didn't, New York City wasn't just like knee deep in manure, which was the big problem at the end of the 19th century. So cars were this amazing technology and they just happened to burn oil, which happened to have, put greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, which meant that decades and decades later, suddenly we figured out that we were doing this and that it had all of these other side effects we don't like, right? So we were doing unintentional geoengineering by driving all these new cars around, right? Because we were pumping CO2 into the atmosphere and changing the climate. We just, for a long time, didn't realize we were doing it. And so we weren't doing it on purpose.
Yeah, we didn't understand our geoengineering, right?
Exactly. So all of these new, the approaches I'm talking about that this novel sort of extrapolates and grapples with are sort of like the second stage of that. There are people saying like, okay, well, we're already geoengineering, but we're not even aware of it. Like, are there ways that we could do this with intent, that we could do this on purpose? And, if you're doing it on purpose, you're able to do it on purpose in a way that creates better results, mm-hmm. right? So that I just found really interesting that now, people are trying to do this stuff intentionally. And also, humans have become such an integral part of the Earth's natural system that there is no such thing as a separate nature anymore, right? Like human activity and other natural systems are completely integrated to a point where there's no way you can say, like, just let nature run its course, for example, or things like that. That just doesn't exist anymore. Like, we are such an integral part of every other part of the biosphere at this point that we cannot make the decision to be Switzerland and try to be neutral. We are inaction is action. So what are you going to do about it?
Yeah. I mean, it's the whole concept of spaceship Earth, right? We're basically on this, in this system that we have to basically manage ourselves now because we're controlling it so much anyway. That's
exactly.
I mean, this is why I like you having on the podcast, because you could basically run the whole thing yourself and you actually understand.
Well, I don't know about that.
You're one of the few writers I know who actually understands science, which is pretty wild, which is great.
I mean, I just find it fascinating. And I think that what's really interesting about that metaphor of spaceship Earth is that that's a pretty recent metaphor, right? Like, when was that coined? Was it the 60s?
That's like a Carl Sagan kind of thing, right?
Like Carl Sagan, Stuart Brand, that whole like era. And what I think is really interesting is that metaphor is becoming more and more true, right? In the sense of like when it was coined, it was like pointing out an anomaly of like, oh, like we could look at the world in a different light. Mm-hmm. And I think that what we're finding now is that like, okay, yeah, like that, the metaphor of Earth being a spaceship is getting more and more true because you just can't deny it anymore, right? It's like now, whoever the chief engineer is on that spaceship, we're playing such a big role. You have to start thinking differently about it. It's fascinating. It's fascinating. And I think that, one of the things that's sort of interesting is that these are big changes, right? Like these are really fundamental shifts, and they're happening very quickly. They're happening way faster than like one generation of people, which, you know, if you look historically, there were very few systematic changes to human life that happened over thousands of generations, let alone within one generation. And so I think one of the interesting things as a storyteller, as a novelist, that I think about is how basically our culture needs to catch up to all of these changes. That the culture, the stories we tell ourselves, the stories we tell our children, and, you know, like the way that we turn fact into meaning is a process that takes time. And it takes time for us to sort of process and grapple with these new questions. And I think that we basically need almost like a new mythology for this age of technological acceleration. And we're only starting to dabble in it. Like we're only starting to even figure out what the right questions are to ask. And I think that that will translate into some really different aspects of human culture that prepare us better to live in this kind of a world where maybe some of the old, you know, the stories, the cultural stories that have sort of been the foundations beneath our worldview for many generations don't necessarily apply, right? Some of them might, but because we're changing the rules, now we need new documentation.
So what does that look like? And what does that look like in practice? What does this new media look like? I'm trying to actually understand that, because we're kind of in a position now where a book, as great as it is, probably isn't where it comes from, right? It isn't the medium that people are going to consume to understand the future. It's going to be a VR. It's going to be a TikTok or something ridiculous. How do we tell that story now in 2020?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that there are two ways to answer that question. The first is that I'm actually not talking about format. I'm mm-hmm. talking about the stories themselves, whatever format they take. So, you know, look at Disney, right? So Disney took fairy tales that have been around for a very long time and then turned them into cartoons, which were a new format, right? Mm-hmm. So like, yes, I think that there are many exciting innovations happening in like basically media formats where you can tell stories in new ways. And I think that that's, I like dabbling with those. Like, what's a good example? A year or two ago, I worked with a web designer and an illustrator, and we created a website that the entire site was a bespoke site designed for one short story. You can check it out. It's truebluestory.com. And what was really interesting about it is that because we were designing the whole site from scratch to only be about this one story, rather than if you imagine like a publication like The Atlantic or The New York Times or something like that, where they have to design their site in such a way that they can publish many, many stories and use it for many different things. This was like laser focused, special purpose site. And we were able to do things that I've never seen people do before. So as an example, we did what we called narrative responsive design. So yeah, responsive design refers to the fact that, you know, say you're looking at a website with an article on it, and then you look at it on your phone, obviously like the format needs to change so that it's legible on your phone and still looks mm-hmm. good, right? So like that's an obvious example of responsive design. We took that a step further. So we had hand-drawn illustrations. And then if you look at it on your phone or on a widescreen monitor, when you go between the two, we don't just change the size of the illustration, which would be like a normal way to do responsive design. We actually change the content. So when you see it on a monitor, looking at us, yeah. So say you're looking at like a a street, like a street in New York City, right? And there are a bunch of people on it, and the protagonist is doing something, right, in the middle of the scene, right? On your widescreen monitor, you see a lot. Like, you see many pedestrians, you see people walking down to the subway, you see pigeons, whatever, right? But when you look at it on your phone, that's a much smaller space. If all we did was shrink that image, you wouldn't be able to see the action, right? Mm-hmm. It would be too small. It wouldn't work right. So we actually put all of the different components of that initial piece of art, the pedestrians, the pigeons, what have you, onto different layers. And then when you look at it on your phone, the whole image rearranges itself for your screen. So when you on your phone, you're still seeing the primary action, the narratively crucial part of that image is still highlighted, but now you're not seeing 17 other of the pedestrians, right? Because they weren't that important. But if you look at it on your widescreen, you need that, because otherwise the scene feels thin, right? So we did a bunch of, we incorporated a bunch of this sort of like experimentation into building that site. So I think that, you know, that was really fun, and it pushed my boundaries as a, or my sort of horizons as a storyteller. And I think that the same was true on the design and the illustration side. And, you know, won an award, which we were thrilled with. It was really fun. But what I was referring to was something totally different. And that is not that formats will change, which they are and will, but also that literally the stories those formats are packages for mm-hmm. are changing as well. So like a good example of this is science fiction itself. Like the first real science fiction story was written by Johannes Kepler,
okay.
right? A couple hundred yep. years ago. And it's wild. It's incredibly thought-provoking. I'd actually highly recommend your listeners check it out if they're interested. And it's the start of this new sort of genre that basically was coincidental with the scientific revolution, right? Because suddenly people saw that science started to change how we understand our place in the world and how we understand the universe. And then science did something even more than that. Like it actually allowed us to build new tools, right? That, mm-hmm. that changed many other things about our lives, that changed our daily work, that changed how media got disseminated, right? Like the printing press, right? And so you can see this thing that didn't have a name for hundreds of years sort of starting to burgeon. You have like Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, right? Like you have all of these things. And suddenly in the 20th century, this new genre starts to emerge where it's people trying to grapple with how science and technology are changing our lives in fiction, right? Like they're trying to play with the questions that science and technology raise through stories, which is how we make sense of the world, right? So I think that's the kind of change I'm trying to think about, right? It's like, how do actually the underlying stories themselves change? And what are the right questions that we should be grappling with? And then you can also play with many new tools in order to articulate the stories that you tell in new ways and a new format.
Fascinating. All right, dude. When is the new book coming out? The book is in May, right?
Yep, May 20th. Veil comes out May 20th in all formats.
And then everybody should read all of your previous books. You really can't grasp the story unless you read all eight other books.
Well,
I'm trying to get you more sales here.
That's a fabulous idea. Yeah, yeah. No, I think that. Hope if you enjoyed this conversation, I hope you would enjoy my other book. They're not all in one series, though, so you can read them independently and start wherever you like. I often recommend that folks start with either Cumulus or with Bandwidth. I think those are sort of like two of my most popular books, so they're a good entry point to my work. And if your listeners enjoy them, I'd love to hear what they think of the story.
All right, wonderful, Elliot Pepper. Thank you for joining us on Technotopia. This has been great.
Thanks, John. This was a lot of fun.
Thanks.
Technotopia is brought to you by Happy Fun Corp. Happy Fun Corp is a design-driven technology company in Brooklyn, New York that specializes in building mobile and web applications for startups and Fortune 500 companies. Whether it's a new mobile or web application that will help people experience the internet in a fun new way, or software that will interface with a new piece of top-secret hardware, Happy Fun Corp is always up to the challenge. Big or small, Happy Fun Corp loves building software and loves working with great people. Come build with them. HappyFunCorp.com.